Welcome to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. This show can be heard on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Friday at 1 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to dreamvision7radio.com, click Listen Live, and enjoy the show.
Hello, this is Dr. Emmett Miller. Welcome back to Conversations with Extraordinary People. Here, our goal is to look beyond the superficial, the wisdom that our guest brings us. So once again, it's time to relax, focus your mind, and open your heart to the power within. Welcome to another paradigm-shattering conversation. And today, we'll be in conversation with a really powerfully paradigm-shattering fellow, Ken Pelletier. I first met Ken back in the 1970s when I was teaching my new approaches to medicine and healthcare to resident psychiatrists at Stanford University. Ken was in one of those classes, and I got to know him. He has been a huge force in our movement to transform the healthcare system by working with corporations, professional training institutes, and government agencies. Even back in the 1970s, we can see how he and his books and articles clearly predicted the healthcare crisis and the financial crisis in healthcare in which we now find ourselves. But before you meet Ken, I'd like to offer an overview of our culture and the mistakes it makes because of the paradigm it uses in addressing the majority of our illnesses and diseases. First off, there's our cultural habit of looking at the mind and body as separate from each other. It's harmful, and it prevents us from true healing. Trying to deal with illness by merely treating its signs in the physical body is as foolish as that fellow who killed the goose that laid the golden eggs. Oh, let's cut the goose open and find the mechanism that creates these eggs, and then we can just turn it on full speed and make lots of eggs and not have to feed a goose. Nope, we can't get a golden egg without a whole goose. Duh. Mind and body are not separate. Neither works without the other. Western medicine has taken a course quite different from that taken in every other culture in regards to health and disease, and looking at the human mind and body. And as a result, we've been able to eliminate and deal only with those diseases that are not really diseases, but symptoms. Rarely, unless your doctor's a surgeon, rarely is that doctor treating anything beyond the symptoms. That and a little antibiotics, perhaps. So, what this really means is that about 90 to 95% of the illnesses we experience here in the Western world, and especially in our current medical system, is because most of our illnesses are really the result of dysfunctional mind-body relationships. At first blush, you might think that I'm exaggerating with that 90 to 95% number. I think not. The vast majority of illnesses in our culture are not due primarily to external agents. When's the last time you've heard of someone being injured by a rock falling on their head, or shot by a bullet, or attacked by the cholera organism? The chief sources of illness in America and in developed and developing countries that are imitating America are, number one, stress, whose toxic effect on the cells of the body are the primary problem in many illnesses and serve to exacerbate diseases of other etiologies and slow down the healing process from all the rest. On the other hand, if people have effective tools such as deep relaxation, meditation, and mindfulness that permit them to deal effectively with potentially stressful situations, these illnesses do not occur. Or else, when illness does occur, it heals much more rapidly. Number two, the second huge source of illness is the way we behave, our behaviors, our patterns of eating, sleeping, exercising, smoking, using alcohol, and thinking, for instance. I'll give you a couple of examples. Let's just take a look at some of the most deadly diseases in our culture. Like the number one killer, heart disease. People's minds and bodies are not in harmony. Therefore, they eat foods that they shouldn't be eating because of emotional reasons. Those foods cause their blood vessels to narrow, starving the heart muscle of oxygen because they feel so disempowered at a deep level. People who've learned to love themselves, who have rich, rewarding relationships, who are happy with their lives and feel a sense of mission or purpose and value, and they feel good about themselves. And they tend to pay much more attention to their habits of exercise, their habits of eating, and all the other behaviors that can prevent the metabolic syndrome and the obesity that predisposes to cardiovascular disease, stroke, heart attack, and so forth. If you have metabolic syndrome, for instance, your likelihood of having a heart attack is doubled, and your chances of developing diabetes increases fivefold. According to a National Health Survey, more than 1 in 5 Americans has metabolic syndrome. Wow, you say. And how many people have metabolic syndrome? Well, according to a National Health Survey, more than 1 in 5 Americans has metabolic syndrome. And the number of people who have metabolic syndrome increases with age, affecting more than 40% of people in their 60s and 70s. Most people can eliminate or prevent metabolic syndrome simply by changing certain habit patterns, physical exercise, weight loss, choosing food wisely so that carbohydrates are avoided, limiting alcohol. Theoretically simple to do. But in reality, what would be necessary is for people to be given the tools to change these behaviors and a way to connect with a sense of purpose and mission in life. People whose lives of mission and purpose are motivated to put the time and energy into staying healthy. Ultimately, then, our sense of who we are, our ideas about the world, our ideas about health, and our ideas about how we think about ourselves are crucially important. And because we learn these things from the schools and the businesses and the institutions that we're exposed to, going in and making some change in those systems is one of the most effective ways of beginning to bring about that transformation that we need to see individually in people, and at the same time contribute to the social transformation that is long overdue. And our guest today is Ken Pelletier, and he has some really excellent information for us. Stay tuned. Today's guest is Ken Pelletier. You may know Dr. Pelletier as a clinical professor of medicine at the University of Arizona School of Medicine and at the University of California School of Medicine in San Francisco. You may be aware of him as the author of more than 10 best-selling books on mind-body health, including the groundbreaking Mind as Healer, Mind as Slayer, and Sound Mind, Sound Body, and his most recently released Alternative Medicine, What Works and What Doesn't. But you may not know that he is also the founder of the Corporate Health Project, health consultant to many Fortune 100 companies, and was director of the NIH-funded Complementary and Alternative Medicine Program at Stanford. But I have known him for more than 30 years, much more as a warm, honest, loving and brilliantly creative fellow with a global perspective and a practical bent and a really good friend. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you, Hemet. It has been a long, wonderful friendship.
Yes. A long, strange trip. I can remember your early work on stress had been very important to me. It was something I was working with in my within my medical practice back in the 70s, but I think it was your perspectives on stress that really helped me discover how to both prevent its harmful effects and as well to teach people how to harness its energy so as to increase productivity and performance and so forth. And what's new in stress research these days?
Well, it's interesting. When you bring back good memories, Mind is Healer, I actually wrote in 1977. And that was really grew out of a lot of basic research at UCSF in pain perception and bringing yogis and other practitioners, adept meditators, we ended up calling them, into the laboratory to see could they really change, could they really control and regulate the involuntary nervous system, pain, bleeding, etc. And we were really able, really among the first groups, if not the first group, to document that these were in fact accurate. They could do this. What was interesting, and it's a roundabout way of answering your question, is in 1992, when Mind is Healer was 25 years old, it was sent out by the publisher, and the question was, should we leave it as, quote, a classic, or should we modify it and update it? And uniformly, the response was, leave it as it is, but write a preface. So I wrote a new preface, ostensibly updating the information. To me, what was interesting is that although the biochemistry, the neurophysiology, even some of the genetics had become much more sophisticated, linking the mind and body, the actual practices were the same, identical in 1992 and 1977, and really had been for hundreds of years. So in terms of what is new in the stress area, I think our understanding of the fact that stress actually affects individuals at the cellular genetic code level is new. That insight is new within the last year, that excess of stress actually has a visible short-term impact on the genetic encoding and the way that cells replicate. But the interesting thing also to me is that the same practices that have been around for hundreds of thousands of years are still the best practices in terms of what we can do to change that impact.
So that's really interesting to discover that the tools and techniques that have been used for so many eons are still proving to be the most effective.
It is. And there are devices, if you will, that assist, such as biofeedback instrumentation. But the biofeedback instrument, if you think about it, uses and amplifies the electrical activity that the person, the practitioner, has been working with intuitively and through instructions, meditation, yoga, martial arts instructions all along. So it really is the same process. It really is the same practice. It's just using technology, if you will, to amplify the signals and in some ways make the learning easier.
Do you have any favorite devices that are current these days?
I've actually been away from the instrumentation, at least that part of instrumentation, for quite a long time, although I do know that now they're based on patterns, so you don't have necessarily a single signal like, you know, an electrical activity of the brain or the muscles or the circulation, but they have patterns that an individual, so you might, almost like playing a video game, if your brain waves and muscle activity and respiration and peripheral circulation are all within a certain area, you'll light up kind of a middle part of the screen like a target. And if it's not, you'll see, you know, how they've been scattered, because one of the basic underpinnings of any mind-body approach is that mind and body become harmonious. They really are in sync. And stress is when they're out of sync, and out of sync chronically. And that chronic out of sync is what we call a lot of different names for many different conditions. But when they're in sync, when they're in harmony, then that's when you really have the basis for, or a major component of optimal health. It's not the only thing, to be sure, but it provides a basis from which people can make, I think, better choices about diet, about exercise, about relationships, about the environment, all those places that give an individual an internal place from which to make better judgments, clearer views, clearer commitments.
It's something we can use at every level in our culture these days, making better decisions, being able to read the truth that's in the environment, accuracy of perception, and being able to make wise choices. Speaking of which, what do you think about the national healthcare debate?
Well, it's interesting. I am part of the committee that has focused on the Wellness at the Worksite initiative, and this is a presidential appointment. And it is a committee that is composed of seven outside individuals. Then there are four representatives from the Office of Personnel Management, four from the Office of the Budget, and four from the White House. And the charge of this committee is to help develop the guidelines for developing health promotion disease management programs that will then be offered and available to all 2.5 million federal employees. And that's the largest workforce in the world, and it's the first time there's been a serious commitment to doing this. The committee is chaired by Zeke Emanuel, who's Rahm Emanuel's older brother. He's an oncologist by training and has done a great job of really harnessing this. And we actually have moved very quickly, and the RFPs, the request for proposals, from this, based on the recommendations of this committee, are actually due to be posted, I believe, this week. Then there'll be about a 30-day period in which people in the private sector can propose, how would you have a stress management program, a cholesterol program, hypertension, whatever it happens to be that is the chronic issue. But to have the private sector bid on these requests, these RFPs, and be able to be the actual providers of the program, that was a big, big step. And then there'll be about a 30-day turnaround, and at least what it looks like now is that by the end of this year, by the end of 2009, that the funding will actually be committed and these programs begin in certain sites. Not all 2.5 million people will have access immediately, but a fairly large number, and it would ramp up very, very rapidly. So we've had a much more narrow focus, but got the job done very efficiently. My concern about the larger national debate is it is not about health. It really is about money. And if you take... ostensibly, it's to bring 47 million, somewhere between 47 and 50 million uninsured individuals into coverage to provide health insurance for those who do not have it, provide portability, and to eliminate pre-existing conditions. Problem is, if you look at the price tag, which is over $1 trillion and will probably climb, if you divide 47 million or 50 million into 1 trillion, that number per individual makes absolutely no sense. And there are many other nuances, of course, and that's a very crude measure. But to me, what it graphically illustrates is that the debate is not about health. It about who is going to benefit from hundreds of millions of dollars adding up to $1 trillion that's going to be allocated to this effort.
When you say it makes no sense when you divide it out, do you mean it's too small a number?
Sorry, Emma, I couldn't quite hear that.
So you say it makes no sense when you divide those numbers out, when you divide the 50 million into the trillion? Is the number that you get larger than one would expect or lower?
Staggeringly larger.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Staggeringly larger. I don't even have a calculator that could do the math.
Uh-huh.
But it would be millions of dollars per person. And when the objective is to make healthcare, universal healthcare, for people in the United States more accessible, that number makes no sense. Now, you juxtapose that. My concern is that, and I've stated this for many, many, many years, is that money is not the issue. It is a matter of wasted resources. We're applying surgeries and pharmacologies and hospitalizations to chronic illnesses, which need to be prevented, and they also need to be treated non-invasively and through lifestyle and behavioral change. And we overuse technology. As an example, there are more MRIs in the city of San Francisco than in all of Canada. That's not a necessary expenditure. That's excessive. And yet, despite these overwhelming expenditures, the United States spends almost twice as much per person per year as any nation in the world. And yet the World Health Organization just about a month ago came out with a comparative study looking at the health outcomes in the top 40 nations in the world. And the United States ranked 37th out of 40 in terms of health outcomes and was tied with Serbia. So we're spending the most of any nation on earth, and our outcomes in terms of what you actually get from those expenditures rank in the absolute bottom and in effect comparable to what really is a third world nation.
Yeah, amazing. In fact, there's a great video on YouTube about hooray, we made it to number 37.
I'm not hearing you, Emmett. Sorry.
Oh, there's a great video on YouTube, which is a kind of a spoof on that, which is hooray, we're number 37, and they play some they play their song, and they sing through all the countries that have better health outcomes than we do, we who are paying more than twice as much as anyone else. That's pretty amazing.
That's fascinating. I haven't seen that, but if we wait long enough, we'll probably make it all the way to 40.
Yeah.
The trajectory since the early 60s, our relative ranking to these 40 nations, despite increasing expenditures since the 1960s, has declined equally quickly relative to these countries. So if we wait long enough, we'll be spending more, and actually we'll probably make it all the way to number 40.
Even with the biggest budget of all. Even though we're spending so much, amazing. Well, what's the possibility that that we might actually start looking where the problem is, looking where the real source of our issue is, rather than to continue to sort of go after the symptoms? I remember you used to say that. We didn't have a healthcare system. We had a pathology management system.
Right. Actually, the quip I used was a disease management industry, because disease is, in fact, the province of medicine. Management is ostensibly what we do, and at 1/7 of the total U.S. economy, it's certainly an industry. So it's not even pejorative. It's just descriptive. And I'm glad you asked what you did, because despite the overwhelming magnitude of these, I'm really profoundly optimistic that we can make a difference, because every other nation on earth has done better, and there are many, many models out there. For instance, there is a much greater emphasis on primary care in every nation that has better outcomes. So we need to reinvest in just basic primary care, medical services, Secondly, we really do need to ensure universal access, because all of that care that doesn't take place in a reasonable way in a primary care office ends up in an emergency room, in a hospital, in a trauma center, where it costs infinitely more to produce an outcome. Another is that there is a much more circumspect use of pharmaceuticals. For instance, in France, the use of antibiotics is about 15 to 20% of that is used in the United States, and yet the infectious disease rate, control of antibiotic resistance, is all better in France. And that's just one nation. So more judicious use of pharmaceuticals. The other is the private corporate sector is really beginning to weigh in and realize that they have a vested interest in the health of their workers. Any company, it can be five people, it could be 50,000 or 150,000 people, need to have healthy workers. And companies are really realizing that you need to invest in your workers and you need to have them be part of your business strategy. And that's what I've spent 25 years doing that, and that's really finally being taken seriously. And in other industrialized nations, there are many, many more kinds of programs that ensure the health and well-being of their workers. The others, if you look, again, globally, you find there is a better integration of what we call alternative medicine, of herbals, of homeopathy, of chiropractic, of Ayurvedic practices, even stress management and yoga-like practices, into the systems that we see elsewhere in the world. So there's an emphasis on an individual, providing an individual tools and the means to improve their own health and well-being. So I see the evidence-based integrative medicine, which is combining alternative medicine and conventional medicine on the basis of evidence, really is the direction for the future. And we can and will see more of that. And the other, just one last thing in terms of the national debate and how it affects this, is we have this very polarized debate, public versus private. Everyone worries that we're somehow going to be socialist and, you know, it's going to be a public system, and that's equivalent with socialism versus private entrepreneurial delivery of care. Well, the reality is every single system in the world, including Canada, which is often cited purely public option and all the difficulties that Canada has, although I think we trade them for the kinds we have in the United States, all of them have a thriving public system, and they also have a thriving private system. They have private hospitals, private practitioners, concierge medicine. So somehow the idea that once a public system is established as a safety net, that the private system disappears is just it doesn't exist. I mean, that's just a non-argument. So if we take all of these variables and tweak them and begin to orchestrate and direct them, I think this problem is very soluble, and it's soluble within what we are already expending. It does not require a huge expenditure of money. It requires a huge expenditure of will and effort.
Mm-hmm. Well, if, you know, let's say that the healthcare bill actually gets through in some form, which means that there'll be the diversion of, you know, maybe a trillion or more. Was it a trillion here and a trillion there? And soon you're talking about real money. But what would be the way that these new ideas would be integrated into what comes out and what the healthcare bill funds? Is there any consciousness in that healthcare bill about disease prevention and medical self-care and a different approach to chronic illness?
Unfortunately, not enough. It really is, for better or for worse, by and large, of providing individuals access to what exists, which is a broken system in terms of quality of care, integration of care, and financially. So for the short run, the likelihood is that it's actually going to perhaps make matters worse. And that's where this enormous expenditure begins to swell, because of bringing a very large number of individuals, and rightfully so, I have absolutely no issue with that. I'm a strong advocate for that, into a system that is very badly broken. Now, once a bill is passed, it was Medicare as it exists today, which was the last major legislation on a national level, was not perfect when it was passed, and it took a number of years to evolve to what it is now. It's very different now than it was when it was actually initiated. So my hope is that there are certain dimensions in this bill, in whatever bill comes out, and there are still about three or four major variants, that'll be a starting point. And that if there's enough time and enough intelligence where we're allowed to have it evolve over time, that it will begin to incorporate more of these ideas. Certainly, again, the reason I work with the private sector is they're always ahead of the government, and they're always ahead of the insurance companies, because they're the ones that are paying the bills. They're moving very rapidly. You take companies like Dow and Ford and Safeway, and companies that we're working with, they have taken the initiative. They're going to continue to do that. So I think in the work sites is where we're going to see the most promising direction, where you see more primary care. You see a newly evolving concept called patient-centered medical home. It really is primary care, but brought into the work site.
We'll talk a little bit more about the work site in a few moments, but let me just remind everyone that you're listening to Conversations with Extraordinary People, which is a publicly supported program. And you can support us by visiting our online store at shopdrmiller.com. That's shopdrmiller.com. You'll find a huge number of programs there, audio programs, video programs, featuring self-help, healing, and peak performance, guided imagery, meditations, books that I've written, and books that have been written by colleagues of mine that I think are really important. It's really a new site. If you haven't been there, you'll find it's been expanded considerably. There's a new learning center where you can learn about mind-body medicine and the tools of mind-body medicine. There's a large section on stress, anxiety, and depression. And you'll also learn about healing. What is healing? What is self-healing? And what is the process by which you can heal yourself? And, of course, we talk about mind tools, guided imagery, self-hypnosis, software for the mind, and meditation. You'll also be able to see all the upcoming events. You'll be able to see who's going to be on the radio show next week, as well as being able to see where I'll be on other people's shows, or when I'll be doing lectures maybe in your community. And you might as well know it that I keep all the radio shows right there online, and you can find them in a section called Free Resources. And so all of the radio shows that you've listened to here, you'll find are available there in the archives. So you can go back and listen again. You can tell your friends about it. And I've interviewed other great names in healing and in mind-body medicine, just as you're listening today to the great Ken Pelletier, whose contributions have been quite huge. Under free resources, you'll find free audios as well, free meditations, some free classes. And same thing, there are video classes and quite a number of different video clips of myself and other people whose work I want to share with you. And as well, I write articles from time to time about everything from self-healing all the way up to healing our planet, leadership, and the like. And if you want to make an appointment for coaching or therapy or whatever, there's a section called Contact Us. So come visit us at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. Now back to Ken Pelletier and the worksite.
The worksite is where we're going to see the most promising direction, where you see more primary care. You see a newly evolving concept called patient-centered medical home. It really is primary care, but brought into the worksite. For instance, Microsoft has an excellent program where they send primary care practitioners out to the homes of their employees. And there's some excellent evidence already that this is a much more cost-effective way to deliver health to their employees than having them go out to random clinics and hospitals and be uncertain of the quality of care. So that's where we're going to see the first innovation. But having universal access, having portability, so if a person loses their job, they don't lose coverage, and also eliminating the pre-existing condition restriction. If just those survive, and those are likely to survive in any bill, those are very, very large steps forward. The only other thing I would add to that is Medicare is plagued by corruption and it's plagued by fraud. Hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars a year in fraud. And I don't see, and that's one of the things that concerns me, in the new bills, I don't see enough oversight that's going to ensure that bringing these individuals into this system, whatever it happens to be, that we're going to be assured that the monies expended are really end up providing care, as opposed to being subject to out-and-out fraud and theft, which healthcare has been and continues to be very susceptible to.
Quite a can of worms, isn't it?
Well, we've waited.
Yeah.
When we see the systems that exist in Europe and Asia and Canada, these have evolved over many, many decades in a very different culture, different mindset. And it's going to take us a long time to evolve out of a system which historically has grown up in a context which has produced these bad outcomes at growing costs. So it's going to take a while to unwind all of this. But again, despite enormity of the problems, I'm actually very optimistic. You know, the cliche of out of crisis arises opportunity, and I think here is, in fact, one of those times.
I think the debate on this has been very interesting. It's kind of curious that with these huge issues like the disparities in terms of cost, the fact that we're still using a downstream approach and treating symptoms rather than source, the focus seems to be about whether or not they'll provide abortions or not. Isn't it funny what it comes down to in our government?
It is unfortunate that these monolithic issues become the basis on which, you know, huge decisions are made. I mean, certainly my personal belief is that the rights that women have now should and be preserved in any system that evolves of universal care in the United States. That's unequivocal. Whether that happens or not, that's what we talked about earlier, which is that this is not a health debate. It's a money debate, and it's a political debate in the worst sense of the word. What we would really like to see happen is an emphasis on health. And health would be, you know, better primary care, a practice that extends out to other practitioners so that physicians are working with chiropractors, working with herbalists and yoga practitioners and nurses more effectively and all of the allied health professionals. And there are models. There are excellent models for doing this. There are clinics, there are integrative medicine clinics. We're just actually funded to conduct a study of the Marino Center for Integrative Medicine outside of Boston. And we are going to be tracking the real-life experience of patients coming through that clinic because they have an option of whether to choose a purely conventional primary care approach to their condition or to follow an integrative medicine track.
Uh-huh.
And to really look and see what are the outcomes like? Who gets better? What does it cost? What is the satisfaction of the practitioners? What about the patients? So we really begin to understand new models of delivering health. The other part of a health system is for all of us, and I think we are seeing more of this, that we do need to assume a greater responsibility to make better decisions about how to manage stress, better diet, physical, you know, activity, social support networks, really taking care of our environment. And that cannot necessarily be done as an individual, although there's a lot we can do in terms of energy consumption and recycling and all of the things that are familiar to us. And then we can take collective actions, and I'm including in that the concerns and protection of other species. We may be the dominant and certainly the most destructive species on the planet, but I think with that comes an obligation to preserve and protect the other species that inhabit this planet with us. So, and those are all at the level. Those are not government programs. Those are not worksite programs. They're not necessarily even medical system programs, but they are points where individuals can assume and take greater responsibility. If we start working those together, that's where we'll really begin to see more health manifest. It'll be health of individuals, health of our environment, health of our culture, ultimately the health of the planet, which I know you've been a strong advocate for a long time. I think those are all critical, and there is a great deal that all of us as individuals can do. We can get lost in these national debates and huge policy decisions, but really ultimately those derive from individual decisions that collectively have an impact.
Well, there's a kind of familiar mindset in all the things that you're speaking of, really a kind of a way of approaching the world where we're looking at sustainability on the individual level, prevention, restoring harmony and balance, and a sensitivity to our environment and a willingness to focus on sustainability of the natural environment and the community environment as well. So there's kind of an overall theme that seems to run through all of these that you talk about.
I think that's actually a very articulate description, and it seems to me that the common theme is enlightened individual responsibility to become as aware as possible of the consequences of our actions. And that can be within our family, within our work site, within our culture, on our planet, and vis-a-vis other species. And also to have a more global perspective. Far too few individuals travel outside the United States. And the world is not like it is in the United States by and large. And it's not necessarily good or bad. It's not to apologize for the standard of living enjoyed in the United States, but to recognize there are other cultures and other countries and entire continents where that standard of living is greatly compromised. And we are, meaning I believe the United States, if I'm reading the global politics and the economy correctly, are going to be getting an interesting taste of what it's like to not necessarily be the dominant world leader with the rise of China. The growing economy, the number of individuals, the fact that the United States is the largest holder of debt of the United States is China. So suddenly to think that somehow that's going to be dictated by the United States as far as China's political policies is naive at best. That's not going to happen. In fact, just the opposite may begin to happen.
They own us. Yeah, almost. It's almost as if China owns us.
Well, in a sense, they do, because they control. They have lent the most money to the United States in this time, consistently over decades, but certainly during this time of economic crisis, that China has become the largest lender, if you will, to the United States. So it's difficult to argue, if you will, with the largest lender. And the impact is going to be both positive and negative. What that remains to be needs to be thought through. But the point is that the future is going to be very different. It's going to be much more interdependent. I hope that it will be one in which we realize that there's a balance that needs to be struck, that the responsibility of leadership and power needs to be tempered by compassion, needs to be tempered by understanding and respecting other cultures. If not, it's going to be imposed on us. Either we willingly accept that different role in the world, or it's going to be imposed on us.
Yeah, and I think that same, the importance of our being able to be, I think it sort of goes back to what Gandhi said, to think globally but act locally, and that it's really become necessary for our communities to look within for us to be able to see what are the resources that we have, because things are changing so dramatically.
Correct. And again, it goes back to since healthcare, medical care issues are so important in terms of individuals' lives, that to take on a greater measure of responsibility, part of what I've tried to do is to take the scientific literature, so evidence-based healthcare, but to have that go into areas like herbal medicine or Ayurvedic or homeopathy or acupuncture, areas that are not familiar to us, that come out of these other cultures that we're going to have to increasingly live with and respect and learn from. We've had quite an arrogant approach in science, that there's only one way of conducting science. There was only one way to provide medical care. There's only one way to optimize health. That's obsolete. That simply doesn't exist anymore. What we call alternative medicine is about how 90% of the world gets its health care. And systems don't exist like acupuncture for over 3,000 years. Acupuncture is a 3,000-year-old system. No system exists for 3,000 years without effects. And we're beginning to see in chronic pain and other conditions how acupuncture is a very, very effective alternative. So we need to be open-minded. We need to use science, we need to use discipline, but we need to open our minds to different ways that can work and how we can apply that and what our role as individuals are in in allowing this to happen, not making it happen, really allowing it to happen.
Mm-hmm. Very wise comments indeed, Ken. And what's at your growing edge these days? What's most exciting to you in the work that you're doing and in the changes that you see happening around this?
I mentioned earlier that in the introduction that you've been noting it, the Corporate Health Improvement Program, or CHIP, and CHIP is actually 25 years old in 2010, and it's an ongoing research program. We have about 15 companies that participate. These have included Ford, IBM, Prudential, NASA, American Airlines, Pfizer. I mean, it's been and is Pepsi, an astounding program. In fact, Walgreens is actually just the newest participant. What we do is we meet twice a year with the medical directors of these companies, and we develop programs that they then implement, or we implement with their employees in their work sites, and we assess them for both clinical outcomes and cost outcomes. The emphasis is on prevention and also on optimizing health, because the companies, again, realize that they need to have healthy, functional, happy, in the purest sense of the word, employees who are committed, involved, and active, and that affects their performance and productivity. So the reason I like it is it's very positive. It affects, hundreds of thousands of lives of the employees and their dependents, their children, their spouses, by conducting these programs, but also it's a health model. We develop programs that, for instance, we just submitted it for publication, a study with Ford Motor Company. We called it an integrative medicine intervention for back pain. And we had conventional care be the control site, and then it was conventional care for back pain plus acupuncture, chiropractic, and a mindfulness, mind-body meditation technique. And what we're seeing is that it costs less, it relieved back pain better, people got off medications, they returned to work sooner, there was less recidivism. In other words, very, very practical, positive outcomes, but bringing together conventional with alternative medicine. And that excites me, to take a very practical issue, look at the evidence, combine what's good in conventional care, what is really evidence-based and works in the alternative realm, put it together, make a difference, and kind of keep moving forward. So that has been, for me, you know, a major exciting area for 25 years. It probably will go for another 25 because we're really getting results and we made a difference. And out of the private programs being conducted in companies, those are programs to be adopted by other employers, by any group of individuals. It certainly could be developed and implemented within the federal government. That's a next step I'm hoping happens.
Oh, great. No wonder we probably have about 5 minutes left. I wonder if we could get you to say a little bit about Helio.
Yes. Helio.com is a new website. It's H-E-A-L-L-I-O, Helio.com. Started by two friends, there is a council of healers that they've asked to help think through a network, and Emmett are one of those individuals, and I'm very happy to invite you to participate.
Thank you.
But what makes it different is instead of a global website that attempts to solve all the world's problems in one website, it's geographically focused. So Helio, for its initial, it is up and operating. Instead of it's focused on San Francisco in about a 250-mile radius. What Helio does that's different is it provides all of the information to help a person make better, more informed decisions, which I really very much believe in. No matter what you choose, at least make it on an informed basis. Then you can go from the information, and through the site, you can find a store, a product, a service, and a practitioner that is physically in your geographic area. You can go right down to the individual practitioner, and although it's not part of the system yet, you can actually make an appointment with that practitioner. So it allows, for the first time that I have seen, a global level of information about care, including conventional and alternative care, but then allows you to go right down to what can I do or get or who can I work with within a very short time to really make this happen. And to me, you know, that's very exciting.
Wonderful. Huh. And that's at helio.com, H-E-A-L-L-I-O.com. So I can invite all our listeners to go over and take a look. It's only about half of its functionality is in place now, but it looks very, very promising. And how can people learn a little bit more about your work and what you've been doing and purchase your excellent books?
Well, thank you. There are really two ways. One is my individual website. It's very simple. It's drpelletier.com. And a great deal of the content, there's no charge for anything on the site. A great deal of the content from Best Alternative Medicine and also from my newest book, which was just published a little over a year ago, called New Medicine, Integrating Conventional and Alternative Medicine, which is really a family medical guide that includes evidence-based alternative practices. So both at drpelletier.com and in this newest book, which is called New Medicine, is really the most current information that I have app that's available.
Uh-huh. And is it Dr. Pelletier with the word doctor written out or just DR?
DR. So yes. Just DR Pelletier.
P-E-L-L.
And it has a lot of information, videos, a number of audio programs on various conditions. I haven't honestly, unfortunately, had enough time to put into it, but at least I've made it no charge access
to
be able to get this information.
So, and that's so it's DRPELLETIER .com where people can learn more about the fascinating work of Ken Pelletier. And it's been wonderful talking with you, Ken. I look forward to seeing you before too long.
The same, Emmett. It's always a pleasure. Really is a pleasure.
Are you spending most of your time in Oregon now?
No, actually, most of the time in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and then quite a bit of time, of course, in Tucson. I seem to spend more of the winter time in Tucson.
I understand that. All right. Well, it's been great talking with you. Take care.
Great. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People, on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more information about Dr. Miller's work, upcoming events, new programs, and how you can change your mind and change your life, visit his multimedia website at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. Conversations with Extraordinary People is produced in the drmiller.com studios. Special thanks to Jesse Churchill and Deborah Beauvais. Thank you.